This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. In our final show before a new governor takes over, we hear from Republicans about to leave office, Governor Bruce Rauner and his Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. We also talk with the now former State Representative Jeannie Ives. She ran and narrowly lost to Rauner in the Republican primary for governor last year, but that doesn't mean you've heard the last of her.
I've got this sort of platform now, which is great, and so I hope to help pull good candidates up into the field so that we can actually compete and win against the Democrats, because I do believe in our party platform.
Also today, what is J.B. Pritzker's agenda? We'll take a closer look. We'll learn about the impact the trade fight with China is having on farmers. And if you have a kid ready to go to college, there's a tool available that could save some money. That and more coming up on this episode of Statewide. This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll talk with Jeannie Ives. Her term in the Illinois House just came to an end. She has become the conservative firebrand in Illinois. We'll find out about her plans going forward. Also, Governor Rauner gives his final State House news conference, what he had to say, that and more ahead. Next up, Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker takes office on Monday on the heels of the most decisive election victory in a generation, and he'll be working to pass his agenda through the biggest Democratic majorities in the Illinois General Assembly since the 1960s. That raises a question: what precisely does that agenda consist of? For Illinois Issues this week, our State House editor Brian Mackey set out to catalog the Pritzker agenda, and I had a chance to speak with him about it. So, Brian, one of the critiques we heard a lot during the campaign was that Pritzker was not getting specific on policies. Is that what you found?
No, pretty surprisingly, that's not what I found. I was sort of expecting that. And I think if you base your judgment of Pritzker on what was in the television advertising,
it's time for a governor who will fight for the state of Illinois,
and what was in the debate performances and his speeches, you know, that stuff is geared for a mass audience. It's geared to be consumed in 10-second increments on the television news or on commercials before people have a chance to reach their DVR button. And it's pretty simplified.
That's why I'm asking for your vote in this election.
But if you actually dig down a little bit, he did have a very detailed policy section on his website. There were 21 separate web pages dealing with a bunch of different issue areas. And I just was curious. I added it all up. There are more than 19,000 words of policies. Now, a lot of this stuff is principles, more so than actual specific initiatives, but I was surprised to find that there were a fair amount of specifics there. Reviewing that, I actually even went back and did listen to the debates, and he does, from time to time, get pretty specific even in that context, between all the sort of attacking and Rauner failed stuff we heard too.
Let me say why progressive income tax is so incredibly important for this state. In those communities that have been forgotten, that is where we need to focus real resources. I'm in favor of independent maps so you have more competitive elections. I'm in favor of legislative leader term limits. I was the first candidate to put out a plan for expanding health care across the state of Illinois. Of course, we ought to ban bump stocks and ban high-capacity magazines and pass a gun dealer licensing bill. I really believe that we should look seriously at building that airport.
Even the Piatone Airport, which, who has talked about that in state government for the last 4 to 8 years, got a specific mention in a debate. And as he mentioned there, you heard his plan for opening the state Medicaid program for everyone. And so there is actually quite a bit there. It's a long checklist if you want to follow along at home.
Well, arguably the biggest issue facing the state is the financial problems it has. What's his plan there?
Well, we heard him a moment ago talking about the graduated or progressive income tax. From his standpoint, that is not an immediate fix. That takes 2 years before it could go on the ballot, and then voters still have to approve it, and there's going to be a lot of opposition to that. So in the interim, he had previously talked about changing the state tax system to make it introduce a little more progressivity, try and get more money from people, but he seems to have backed off of that. So really, it's a bit of a mystery where he's going to try and fix the financial problems. His budget address is in February, and we'll be waiting to hear where he stands on that.
So we know he has a lot of priorities. Do we know what his top priorities are?
Yeah, his people basically say he's going to start by focusing on, I guess, what they call the kitchen table issues, raising the minimum wage, trying to bolster the support for labor unions in state government, things like that, things that with Democratic supermajorities should be fairly easy for him to get through and perhaps set some of the more challenging, expensive plans for later in his administration.
That's our State House editor, Brian Mackey. You can find more on the Illinois Issues reports about the Pritzker agenda, available now at our website at statewideshow.com. Former State Representative Jeannie Ives emerged as almost a beacon of hope for far-right conservatives in Illinois. She gave up her seat to challenge Governor Bruce Rauner in the 2018 primary, but narrowly lost. Jacqueline Driscoll sat down with Ives to talk about her political future and what she sees as the challenges ahead for the Republican Party.
As you leave the House of Representatives, what will your new role be, specifically in politics?
Well, I hope to still be a place where people can go to for information on exactly what does a policy mean to them in their real lives. So if we put in a gas tax, do you know that that would be the highest in the nation? What does that mean for our border communities? There's all sorts of things. How about for pensions? If we don't reform pensions, what does our budget look like? Are these pensions salvageable? But there's a lot of information to delineate here. So I hope to be a voice for people to help connect dots from public policy to what it means for them in their lives and why Illinois needs to really reform how we run our government. And so that's what I want to do in the future.
Will constituents throughout Illinois still see you as present within the Illinois GOP?
Well, I hope so. Obviously, I'm not looking to take on a leadership post. I think by nature of me having run at the governor level, that gives me credibility at least. And it also has given me a lot of good folks that I've met around the state that trust me, that want more information from me. I've already been asked to do a number of dinners around the state as well, and I plan on doing those. And so I've got this sort of platform now, which is great. And so I hope to help pull good candidates up into the field so that we can actually compete and win against the Democrats, because I do believe in our party platform. But I'm not looking to be the GOP leader, if that's what you're wondering.
Would you consider another gubernatorial run?
I have not ruled that out. I think that governors have a lot of power. And in the state of Illinois, you absolutely have a lot of power. And the next 4 years for Illinois are going to be very difficult. These budget issues that we have are not going to go away. The budget they passed last year, $1.2 billion minimum over budget. So we've got enormous pressures coming up. They still want to spend $350 million more this year on education. That will have added $1 billion more to education, yet people are seeing no property tax relief. We have over $900 million more in additional pension requirements this budget year. They don't know how they're going to pay for that. You have back pay issues for state workers. They don't know how they're going to pay that. Nobody has talked about the big budget pressures, and I don't see from the Democrats them moving forward in reforming how we spend our money. It's going to be difficult for the next 4 years. I don't think they have the answers. And I think that people that I've been working with, I think we have better answers and better solutions so that long-term Illinois can become a healthy state again.
Do conservatives in Illinois have any allies in either chamber currently?
I would actually argue that the Republican caucus in the House is more conservative now than the previous legislatures. And that's because many of the more moderate Republicans, the Republicans who voted for a tax increase, largely are gone from the chamber. And so you've got the people that replace them are largely more conservative. So I think since I've been there for 6 years, every single election cycle, the Republican caucus has gotten more conservative. And I think that's a good thing, because conservatives believe in personal responsibility. And it's only through personal responsibility that you're going to get government to be right-sized.
Republicans did not do well in Illinois in November. We saw that Democratic supermajorities, J.B. Pritzker, our governor-elect, obviously, Democrat, all statewide offices are held by Democrats. So two-part question here. Mm-hmm. What do you attribute that to, one? And the second part, what does this mean for the future of the Republican Party in Illinois? Where do they go next?
Those are great questions. I mean, it does look pretty bleak for Republicans in the state of Illinois, because the electorate has been so bamboozled by the Democrat powerhouses. I mean, they have all the money in the world to lie about our candidates, which they did repeatedly. This idea that was really Rauner's fault, that these budgets were a problem, is not true. Mike Madigan passed first a budget that was $4 billion out of balance, then a $7 billion budget that was out of balance. They've never corrected their spending problems. They were able to win the argument, though, because Rauner was so weak. And then, you know, Rauner was never going to win once he capitulated on sanctuary state policies, taxpayer funding of abortion, bailed out Exelon, a $2 billion net profitable company on the backs of ratepayers, even as we export energy. So all we're doing now is subsidizing energy going across state lines. I mean, so Rauner made a number of bad policy choices so he lost his base. He had no way to move back into electability. He knew that. You had the Trump effect. There were a lot of things going on. They own the maps, so we're already fighting a map issue. The Democrats have complete control. They have all the money, and they have no problem lying about policy choices. Saw lies basically saying that, you know, so-and-so state rep is going to take away your Medicare or your Social Security. Those are federal programs state legislators have no impact on. So they're able to get away with this because the Republican Party has been ineffective. We've been ineffective messengers. We need to start telling the stories about how this is harming folks around the state. These high property taxes are forcing people to flee. It's harmful for the elderly. A gas tax is a regressive tax. As you want to put on a progressive tax and tax the wealthy, a gas tax does the opposite. So we have to explain these policies to people in a meaningful way. And then I think if we can lead on policy and do it together in a combined way, I think we can win elections in the future.
I'm speaking with former State Representative Jeannie Ives about the future of the Republican Party. Now, you've mentioned Republicans need to lead on certain policy issues to be successful in future elections, but do you believe the Illinois GOP is united on these policies you've talked about?
You know, it's interesting. I don't believe that we are. And I, you know, look to the Republicans and I say, look, if we can't agree in one of the highest tax states that we don't need new taxes to solve our problems as Republicans, if that can't be a core belief that we believe in Illinois, then I don't know what else we can agree on, quite frankly. And I am still finding colleagues who are willing to go to, you know, increase taxation or increase gambling to solve our problem or, you know, legalization of pot, making the state then the licensure for the biggest drug dealer. I mean, this is their policy solutions. I have colleagues, Republican colleagues, who believe that. So, you know, we do have to pull together on policy, and we don't have leadership in our party right now to do that, to come up with a core line of things that we all can agree on and basically put out a contract to Illinoisans, because Illinoisans know they are being scammed by the political ruling class on both sides and have been being scammed for decades. They just don't know who to always blame.
I'm going to shift gears just slightly here because I think it's important. 2018 was viewed as kind of the year of the woman with the Me Too movement. Some have criticized Republicans for not being as, for lack of a better term, sympathetic to some of those issues brought forward. You're a female, you're a Republican. What's your response to that?
My response is I was the only governor candidate in the race that was a female and a veteran, by the way. The only female, the only veteran in the race. I think it's alarming because the hashtag Me Too movement, the whole sexual harassment movement, has really been seen more on the Democrat side. So they have the problems with the hashtag Me Too movement. The latest is, you know, Ricky Munoz, the alderman from Chicago. You want to talk about domestic battery, which they like to chirp about all the time. We need more money for domestic abuse. We need more, you know, sensitivity towards domestic abuse. Their own Chicago alderman accused of beating his wife. And he's still in office. Why is and where's not been the huge Democrat call to resign? I don't understand it.
As a female Republican, did you experience any more hardships than your male counterparts, in your opinion?
Well, I would say that there is a coziness among the male colleagues that the women do not have. That is definitely true, even in the Republican caucus. That is definitely true. But it's hard for me to judge myself against everybody else because I know that I'm a lot different than my colleagues. I'm pretty outspoken. Maybe it's my military background. Maybe it's being a mother of five. You're just, you know what? Maybe it's at my age. I'm just not, you know what? I'm not interested in your pettiness. I want to get something done. And I'm not going to play your games. But I feel like I had good relationships with these folks. It's just I had so many policy differences with them. I couldn't understand when they want to give corporate tax cuts to corporations that are just crony carve-outs that the state can't afford. I couldn't understand when most of the colleagues voted for an unbalanced budget. I just had so many policy problems with a lot of the stuff we were advocating for that I don't know why, but I mean, that's probably more the reason that there's not a coziness among some of my colleagues.
Governor Rauner held a press conference and mentioned that the people of Illinois should be scared for what's to come. Is that something you agree with? Is that a statement you agree with?
Yes, I actually am worried because I know the politicians who sit in the seats that got elected, and I know who's in control. And truthfully, that they've been able to get away with unbalanced budgets and bad policy choices and crony handouts to their favored constituencies for so long that they know that they can get away with it. It's like we do have Stockholm syndrome, like we're just used to it. Like one more scam by the political elite is just one more scam. This does not bode well for us long term because people don't call me up and say, hey, by the way, state rep, because my property taxes went up again for like the 12th year in a row. They don't call me up and complain. They just leave. They just leave. And so does businesses. And so in the end, where does this leave you? You've got town after town across the state raising property taxes because they can't afford the government that we have and the rules that are dictated by Springfield. And I don't see that changing because the public sector unions and the other political elite have too much control and the voters have not woken up.
That's the now former state representative, Republican Jeannie Ives. Well, coming up, we'll hear from Governor Bruce Rauner and his Lieutenant Governor, Evelyn Sanguinetti, before their terms come to an end. It's all coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. As he prepares to leave office on Monday, we had asked for a sit-down conversation with Governor Bruce Rauner, an exit interview, if you will, but he declined that request. Still, the governor did address reporters this week in his statehouse office for the last time, and he talked about some of his accomplishments, as well as some things he was unable to do.
Change is hard. Change takes time. The folks that created the massive problems in our state certainly are resistive to change. That doesn't mean that our recommendations are somehow wrong or flawed or incorrect at all. That means it's going to take time to communicate with the voters and get the changes done. Some of our elected officials will fight tooth and nail, as they have, against term limits, fair maps, getting property tax work out of the legislators' hands. My most fervent hope is that the Republican Party be a big tent, as Ronald Reagan advised, not be so restrictive as to throw people out of the party or call them not Republicans and have a small party. I also hope that the Republican Party will remember Ronald Reagan's great advice that someone who agrees with me 80% of the time is my friend and my ally, not my 20% enemy.
Rauner's also been critical of Democrats, even going as far as saying he's scared for the people of Illinois with a Democratic governor and larger Democratic majorities in the legislature.
We have been a national leader in out-migration for what, years, decades? I'm scared that it's going to get a lot worse. The exodus is going to accelerate. There's so much talk about raising taxes. Raise the income tax, raise the gas tax, raise the whatever. Oh, goodness, if you're a working family struggling to make ends meet and your company's not growing, they're not adding people, they're not raising your salary very fast, but things are booming in Tennessee or Georgia or Florida or Texas, say, hey, your spouse, maybe we ought to head out. I'm very scared about this. This is a problem. The exodus could accelerate. And I'm worried that if I'm not there blocking them, that boy, they're going to pass a whole lot of bad regulations. That'll push more employers out. And then you got that death spiral going. And then with the corruption, self-dealing, that's what's been hurting us. That's what we fought against.
The governor had some criticism for his own party as well. Many Republicans broke with Rauner on issues like immigration and abortion. His response.
Republicans, given the people of Illinois, Republicans won't win unless we're moderate in many ways and in many things. And I certainly consider myself a moderate on many things. And if you look at my record and things I've advocated and the bills I've signed, I think most people would say I'm a moderate. That said, if you're going to be a moderate and to win elections, but you're not going to be a reformer and fix the problems, what's the point of winning? And in Illinois, Republicans have won in the 80s and 90s, but then they did the same bad stuff that the Democrats did. Kick the can on pension payments, don't reform the system, raise taxes with no reforms, overregulate businesses. If you're going to moderate to win and then do the same thing as the guy or gal that you were running against was doing, what's the point? And I think Representative Ives is correct that you got to have some principles and you got to be fiscally responsible/conservative. I call it responsible. She would say conservative, but it's balanced budgets. And to me, I hope the Republican Party rallies around a unifying message of being pro-taxpayer and pro-job creator. That I think that can be a unifying message, and that should define the party. The other things we're going to have some vehement disagreements on. Obviously, some of my fellow party members disagree with me on some of my more moderate views. Okay, but that doesn't mean that we can't all be Republicans and push for responsible things for taxpayers and for job creators. But we've got to stop this. Both parties doing the same thing. In a lot of ways, the Republican Party for decades was sort of a weak subsidiary of the Democratic Party. Raise taxes, kick the can on pensions, overregulate, give unaffordable deals to the government unions. What's the point of winning?
And then there's Donald Trump. Rauner has gone to great lengths to distance himself from Trump, even avoiding the president's name in numerous interviews. As the governor leaves office, he talked a little more openly about Donald Trump.
I will say this. I've been asked about the president many times, and I will make a comment. I will say that I support most of the president's policy goals very strongly, and I'm appalled by his personal behavior, just appalled. And how that plays out in the coming months and years is not clear to me. I support the president's goal of ending illegal immigration. That's his goal. He's been clear about that from the earliest days. But in terms of policy to actually get that done, I personally believe the right way to do that is to do comprehensive immigration reform, streamline, simplify, and promote legal immigration, make it much easier and more welcoming legally, but end illegal immigration. And I believe the best way, and I'm very strong about this, I believe the best way to do that is by E-Verify for all employers in America, in every state, along with tough and tougher penalties for employers who break the law and don't hire Americans. That's the way to end illegal immigration. And we combine that with streamlining and supporting legal immigration, I think we'll have a better future for the people of Illinois, the people of America.
That's Bruce Rauner at a news conference with reporters this week as he gets ready to leave office on Monday. While Governor Rauner declined an interview with us this week, we were able to chat with the outgoing Lieutenant Governor, Evelyn Sanguinetti. Daisy Contreras sat down with her to talk about her upbringings with a Cuban mother, an Ecuadorian father, her influence on Governor Rauner's policies, and what it's meant to be the first Latina Lieutenant Governor in the country.
This position has received an incredible facelift, and it all happened not because I'm like so cool, right? It happened because you saw us both on the same ticket 4 years ago. The governor picked his lieutenant governor and they ran together on the same ticket. So if you voted for Bruce 4 years ago, you inevitably got me, right? And this was significant because it shows you that Bruce and I were in sync and are in sync, and we were able to hit the ground running because we picked one another. In times past, the lieutenant governor and the governor ran separately, so they were not always in sync. And I've heard rumors that at times they did not see eye to eye, right? But that was not the case with Bruce and I.
Do you think that your unique background, your personal experiences growing up, going through hunger, having parents that are immigrants, being Latina, did that influence any of the policies that Governor Rauner put through, came to you and asked for some advice on those issues?
Oh, yeah. So listen, I've always had his ear. That doesn't mean he does everything I tell him to do, but I think the relationship has been a very, very positive one. So I've always been very empathetic. And I like to listen to people. And that's what I did in the state of Illinois, traveling to all 102 counties and talking to the people of rural Illinois, for instance, the farmers. And they remind me a lot of our people. And so a lot of them were saying, listen, we need to be able to survive. A lot of us are losing our farms. We need to be able to grow and sell hemp in order to stay afloat. We need to diversify our farms. It's not a Latino issue per se, but I do have empathy for people that are facing hard times, because growing up, it seemed to be one hard time after the next, right? And I was able to take that message over to Bruce, bring him experts, and bring him to the table. But I think it's my background of listening to underserved communities, because I came from one, and finding ways to move the needle. And I do feel that my relationship with Bruce has been a healthy one, because I've been able to open his heart and mind to a lot of issues. The Trust Act was another one. I have great hope for JB and Juliana. I hope that they're able to have that sort of trust where they could respectfully disagree and agree.
There have been talks and just a lot of speculation that the incoming lieutenant governor is going to be more present, more involved. Do you disagree or agree with that critique?
Well, I've met Juliana Stratton, and we've talked on the phone, and I wished her well. My predecessor, Sheila Simon, did the same thing. When Bruce and I won, she picked up the phone, and she first said, congratulations. And the second thing that she said was, what can I do to make this transition seamless? And that's exactly what I did. We had a great conversation. And to me, I don't look at it as a competition of who's going to do more. I worked very hard. I don't think I could have worked any harder. I went through all 102 counties and headed a bunch of task forces for the governor, as well as my statutory duties. But, you know, the more she can do over and above, more power to her, because at the end of the day, we all benefit. You, me, and all of Illinois. We're all Illinoisans.
Moving forward, what do you see as your greatest accomplishment or the legacy that you will leave behind for this office of Lieutenant Governor?
So I'm proud of a lot of accomplishments. So the first project that Bruce had given me was to chair the Task Force on Consolidation of Government and Unfunded Mandates. And I thought to myself, wow, that doesn't sound cool. I'm not saving children, you know, and it's about consolidation and delivering a more efficient, streamlined government. But there was a hunger for it, and on a bipartisan basis, I led a task force, and we made 27 recommendations, and we've seen a lot of those recommendations become law. And I want people to appreciate how important this is. So Illinois has the most units of local government than any other state in the union. Sometimes these units of local government are duplicative. They're overburdensome. We could possibly consolidate some. That is a lot. So I've been very proud of that, even though at the beginning I was hesitant. Something else that I'm very proud of is, as you heard, the Opioid Overdose Prevention Task Force. I co-chaired that task force, and I traveled the state implementing that our recommendations. And I'm very proud of that, because I There were, of course, a lot of sad parts about it. I had to console a lot of parents that lost their children, a lot of people that lost their loved ones to the epidemic. But by hearing people all across the state of Illinois, we were able to make significant changes. For instance, we now have a 1-800 number that people could call to ask questions from any part of the state, any time of the day, 7 days a week, 1-833 to find help. Something else that we did is the prescription monitoring program. We keep on hearing about the overprescribers. We needed to make it law that they let us know their prescribing practices so that we could track it, right? Track those overprescribers. And then, of course, you've heard of Narcan. It's what reverses an overdose and people experiencing that. So we have a standing order on it. So that right now you could go to Walgreens, get Narcan, and if somebody's experiencing an overdose, you could save lives. You could be a first responder today.
For statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras, and I'm here with Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. She's the first Latina Lieutenant Governor in the country. Over the last few years, we've seen more women getting involved in government. What do you tell them that you wish you could have known when you first ran?
Well, I like to tell women to just get involved. So statistically, we need to be asked more often than our male counterparts to run. Statistically, we need to be convinced. And I always love to get out there and talk before women's groups and ladies that want to make a change in their communities. And I try to inspire them to run, be a mentor. And I also tell people, put your money where your mouth is. What does your administration look like? So in other words, I get out there and I let people know, A, American Dream is still very much alive. I don't have to be the first Latina lieutenant governor in the country. And I try to inspire people to be the next one and go even further and become the first Latina governor, all right, in the state of Illinois. And secondly, again, I tell people, find out what you could do internally to move the needle for women and minorities as well.
You mentioned that you want to see a Latina be governor of Illinois. Might you be that person?
You know, I've never said I cannot do something. You know, having failed the first grade, not knowing English, I've always been a fighter. And I've always believed my mother's words. And she would always tell me, Evelyn, en este país, tú puedes subir como la espuma. Evelyn, in this country, you could rise like the foam. So I've gone towards challenges, and yes, I've been afraid, but taken each and every one of them. I've never let anyone tell me that I cannot do it. And I've been challenged many times in life. So if you ask me whether I could be governor, I say, of course, yes. And if you ask me whether I could be president of these United States, I say yes. And if you ask me whether I could be celestial solar system queen, I will leave that to you.
Do you consider yourself a trailblazer?
You know, I get called that all the time. But no, because I consider myself a peligrosa. You know, I'm Hispanic. That is, what do you think it is?
Dangerous
female. I think that's so much better than trailblazer. But yeah, no, so I'm a first. And I had no idea that I was the first Latina lieutenant governor in the country until my swearing-in ceremony. They announced my name. I was coming out onto the stage with my family, and they said, the first Latina in the country. And that's when it dawned on me, the sense of responsibility now, being the first to let those little girls in grade school that came from my same sort of background, that they could do exactly what I did and more.
So what's next for you? Do you have any plans to remain in government, working for government?
Well, I've always been involved. So I got my hands wet in politics when I was part of the Wheaton City Council. I cared for my community. I cared for my sidewalks, how attractive we were to businesses, and stuff like that. That's how I got involved. And then I stayed involved by doing Hispanic outreach as well as female outreach, as I was telling you before. And then I got the attention of this guy named Bruce Rauner. And I sent him a resume. So I guess when you ask me what's next, I don't know, but I do know this. I believe that we should all be involved. I believe that we all have a duty to get out there and vote and get out there and talk to our neighbors about the policies that form us and that are important to us. I think it's healthy. And that's why you're always going to see me in one way or another.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you.
That's Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. Find out more about her at our website at statewideshow.com. Sanguinetti leaves office on Monday. Juliana Stratton will become the state's next Lieutenant Governor. You're listening to Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll hear about a tool that could help college students and their parents when it comes to navigating financial decisions involved in paying for higher education. But next, the Quad Cities will help the NFL announce a few draft picks in the spring. As Michelle O'Neill reports, the city of Rock Island jumped at the chance.
With the 251st pick in the 2018 NFL Draft, always in my heart, San Diego Chargers select Justin Jackson, running back, Northwestern.
That's the kind of announcement we'll probably hear in the Quad Cities on April 27th, the final day of the 2019 NFL Draft. Todd Winter from Rock Island Parks and Recreation says the National Football League called Mayor Mike Tomes to ask if the city where the NFL was born would host part of its draft.
It's just an honor to be reached out to and be asked to participate, and this is a big deal for our city and also for Douglas Park and the history of that park. And we really want to create this event to celebrate the NFL's history in Rock Island and particularly at Douglas Park.
Winter says Rock Island and Augustana College are discussing where to hold the NFL announcements, probably at the school's football stadium.
We do a vintage football game at Douglas Park every year, and we're going to incorporate something similar to that to kind of reenact the first NFL game and then have some sort of kids' activities like a punt, pass, and kick competition.
The Rock Island Independents hosted the first NFL game in September 1920, beating the St. Paul Ideals 48-0. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
This is Statewide. Winter is a time for crop farmers to regroup, fix equipment, start planning for the spring. They'll do this regardless of whether the U.S. and China strike a trade deal, even if it means farmers stick with crops targeted by those tariffs. For Harvest Public Media, Madeline Beck went into the field to find out why they'd stay the path instead of trying something else.
I'm near Dehinda, Illinois, in a 200-foot-long machine shed. On the far end, you can hear a combine running as a mechanic tries to figure out what's wrong with it. On this end, farmer Grant Strom is describing his 80-foot-long planter.
And the seed actually drops right behind here. So the seed tube comes down here, and this is called a shoe.
Strom farms about 5,000 acres with his family and a few other families in Knox County. His two planters will need several weeks of maintenance over the winter to be ready to plant in the spring. He's already ordered his seeds, and even while across the country, piles of harvested soybeans sit in storage awaiting buyers, Grant Strom plans to grow more soybeans this year.
I think a lot of farms are like ours, where as far as planning like a crop rotation, are we going to plant corn, soybeans? I mean, I'd say 90% of our acres are pretty well fixed what we're going to do year in and year out. And a lot of that's just agronomic reasons.
A good crop rotation can help boost yields, and he gets early bird discounts on his seeds. For Strom, his mixture of corn and soybean seed averaged $80 to $90 an acre. Cover 5,000 acres, and you're approaching a $500,000 bill. A lot of Midwest farmers are in the same difficult position. If tariffs with China worsen, they can't just trade out soybeans for other crops. China did start buying some soybeans in December, but it was less than 5% what it bought in 2017. And so a lot of farmers, unable to plan for massive changes, stick with what's worked for them.
I think a lot of farmers that I've talked to so far are keeping to what they know. This isn't the first time they've struggled. They've been struggling now for quite a few years.
Agronomist Stephanie Porter with seed company Golden Harvest stresses that every situation is different. For some, it means ordering seeds that have fewer traits that protect crops from pests and fungus. But regardless, all farmers depend on markets for their crops, and that's where the trade war really hurts. This isn't lost on lenders like Mike Shane, who's the vice president of agriculture banking with F&M Bank in Galesburg, Illinois. He keeps an eye on trade and crop costs, but also monitors the situation of each farmer that takes out loans. It's key to build a relationship with farmers so they'll be open about their problems.
Because when you hide them, they usually just get worse. And then when they do come out, it could be really bad.
And Shane says he won't cut farmers off after a bad year, but...
You know, if a guy shows multiple years of losing money, we want to say, you know, what's going on? We need to stop this. You know, we're probably going to have to stop lending money because we don't want to put somebody out of business.
But Shane says his farmers have largely been doing okay.
You know, guys are watching and they're watching every penny. And it's not just on, you know, the big picture items. They're looking down to the real minimal things, too.
Plus, it helps to have high crop yields and federal bailout money. The Trump administration announced in August it would spend billions to help farmers, namely soybean farmers, suffering from China's tariffs.
I think that payment was the difference between people making money and not making money this year.
But for those who buy seeds for soybeans and other crops hurt by tariffs, there's no guarantee the government will send out more bailout money next season if the trade war continues. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
And an important note, many federal offices have been closed recently because of the government shutdown, stalling ag bailout payments for farmers. In the wake of the Me Too movement, there is a renewed debate over the way some teaching hospitals treat women's bodies. Women who go under anesthesia at these hospitals may be subject to pelvic exams without even knowing it. And in most places, it's legal. Only 6 states, including Illinois, ban the exams. Medical schools argue it's necessary to teach students. But U of I law professor Robin Fretwell Wilson wants to ensure women are allowed to give explicit consent. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman asked Wilson about these exams and how often they occur.
Well, we actually don't have terrific data. What we have are accounts from medical students who say, I'm disturbed. Why aren't we having a conversation about this? As in terms of medical ethics, we have residents saying that it was a normal teaching practice. And so we know the practice happens as a teaching matter. We know that often it's not consented to.
Does this happen only during something like a gynecological surgery or other surgeries as well?
Other surgeries as well. In fact, what sparked the opinion editorial and the call for maybe a sustained change was basically a woman reaching out to me from Arizona who went to the hospital for stomach surgery and then is told by a resident after the fact that medical students had done a gynecological exam. Well, there's some distance between your vagina and your stomach that's not necessary to the care that she received. It was done without her consent. And we hear those stories again and again from usually medical students saying they think that's what happened. Patients often don't know.
So related to that, I mean, Illinois is actually one of 6 states that bans non-consensual pelvic exams. I understand this was a result of public outcry over the issue that goes back to like the 1990s. And then what happened? Did the momentum just kind of fizzle out?
Well, so it seems like it goes in these spurts. There'll be a study or an ethics examination that says we're doing this, and then people go, you've got to be kidding me, right? We've had biomedical ethics for 30, 40 years. Certainly we don't do this. And then the answer back will be usually from students, well, I've been asked to do this, and I didn't feel right about it at the time. And then that will just sort of die out. And maybe laws were sort of passed in the interim. That happened after the Federal Trade Commission had hearings, and there were a set of laws that were passed. But if there isn't oversight by an accrediting body, if there's nobody like looking over the shoulder of attending physicians doing this work with medical students, then I think sometimes the easiest impulse is to say, yeah, what? Nobody will care. We should just get on with it.
And so are you hoping that this issue will get revived, I guess, perhaps now in the wake of the Me Too movement?
I think so. I think sometimes we can make legal changes that are sophisticated, but without that oversight piece, tying it to accreditation, it's hard to operationalize. I think a lot of folks would be deeply, deeply disturbed by knowing that this might have happened to them or could possibly happen to them. So my hope is that we are thinking a lot harder about women's dignity in all kinds of ways, women's capacity and their autonomy, and this should be part of that broader discussion. And like the Me Too movement, I think just, you know, people saying, look, you need to ask, just ask, can be a way that we can get cultural change even when we don't have legal change. We've had this promise of informed consent and promise of autonomy about our bodies for 100 years. We need to make good on it, and we need to make good on it for people who usually are not, you know, in a terribly good position to do that for themselves.
That's law professor Robin Fretwell Wilson speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman. Listening to Statewide. Students trying to choose which college or university to attend have a new tool that could help them make that decision. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes takes a closer look.
You know that thing about getting on an airplane and finding out the person sitting next to you paid way less for his ticket than you paid for yours? Mark Salisbury says it doesn't just happen on airplanes. It can happen in a college dorm room, too.
There's lots of fun stories about this. Not really fun, but I say that in quotes around it. Two students talking to each other in the middle of their freshman year and finding out they've got the same EFC and they've got the same test scores, and one of them's paying $5,000 more than the other one to go to that school.
Salisbury has spent his career in higher education, working at colleges in 5 different states. He's fluent in academic acronyms, that EFC he just mentioned, that's short for Estimated Family Contribution, the money line on financial aid forms. Salisbury has worked in admissions and administration, and he says it's that EFC number combined with test scores that colleges use to decide how much financial aid to offer.
So if folks knew that information before they decided to go to that school, that would help them in negotiating their price.
Yep, that's right. Salisbury says you can negotiate. Once your student receives an award letter, you just
call the school back and say, look, I can't pay this. This is too expensive. Can you bring the price down? And knowing that school's offered other students like you a different price is a pretty powerful way to negotiate.
So how do you find out that information? Well, at the moment, there's no easy way. Salisbury, however, is trying to remedy that by creating a tool he calls Tuition Fit to share real offers that real kids receive from real colleges.
This is not rocket science, really, in a lot of ways. This is something that has been done in other industries.
Like with cars, we know that this, you're
right,
saying with colleges, it's the same thing. The
yep.
Sticker's not what you're really going to pay, but you've found a way to whittle down those factors.
Yeah. Colleges will tell you that they take all these different factors into account and sort of customize a scholarship package for each individual student. The reality is the colleges organize their awards, all the scholarship and aid that they give out, around basically financial need and academic merit, and then they move money around in all the different ways that they want to move it around to make it look like something really fancy when it's actually not. So the sellers, the colleges, know a lot more about what's going on than the buyers. And in those situations, people tend to pay more than they would normally.
Okay, so it's going to depend on students sharing their award letters with you.
Correct.
How does that mechanically work?
First of all, the site is password protected. And then when students upload a letter, we redact all of the private information, block it out, and then we actually send that redacted copy back to the student so that they can see the version that we have redacted. And then if they think we need to redact something that we didn't redact, they can say so. Then we take the pricing data out of that letter and put it into the sort of giant catalog so that then people can see that this price was offered to this student with this test score and this need, and it came from this college.
There are other services that try to predict financial aid offers, but Salisbury hopes the tool he's building will be more realistic.
People like to see the actual price. I don't want some algorithm telling me what they predict. I want to know what they actually are charging.
This isn't Salisbury's only radical idea. In blog posts, he has argued that what really matters isn't so much where you go to college as it is what you do while you're there. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
That will wrap up another edition of Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Glad you could be with us. Join us again next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. To check out our website, statewideshow.com. All of our episodes are there, including this one. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.